Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Beginning our 31st year of disservice to the community. Hello, how are you? I'll tell you how I am. I'm even though I don't live here in London, I want to take this opportunity on behalf of all the citizens who do live here to welcome all of our newest entrants. There's a lot of immigrant bashing going on these days. Apparently, what globalization means is that money can flow freely, but people can't. But there's still some flowing going on of people. And as I say, I want to welcome on the behalf of all the rest of the folks here, all of our new entrants who have become drivers in the last little while, and hope you guys learn the city real soon. Ladies and gentlemen, news from up north of the United States, that is. Toronto, home of Rob Ford. He didn't make the news this week. Gutted we are. But other people did. A woman named Ellen Richardson, according to the Toronto Star, who went to the airport in Toronto, looking forward to flying to New York City, and from there going on a 10-day Caribbean cruise for which she'd paid about $6,000 Canadian. Think of it. She was stopped by the Customs and Border Protection agent from the United States at the Canadian airport. He denied her entry to the United States. She was turned away, she was told, because she had a hospitalization in the summer of 2012 for clinical depression. Richardson is a paraplegic who set up her cruise in collaboration with a March of Dimes group of about 12 others. She was told by the U.S. agent she would have to get medical clearance and be examined by one of only three doctors in Toronto whose assessments are accepted by Homeland Security, none of whom, I'm guessing, work at the airport. She was given their names and told a call to her psychiatrist, quote, would not suffice. She was so shocked and devastated by what was going on, she wasn't thinking about the next question, how U.S. authorities could access her supposedly private medical information. She'd had no discussion whatsoever with the agent at the airport about her medical history or background. She had attempted suicide in 2001 as a result of delusions. Medications put her on an even keel and stabilized her for years with no incidents. A personal relationship breakup in 2012 caused her depression and hospitalization. There was no police involvement. Her condition stabilized again. She has a master's degree in counseling. She sees a psychiatrist with whom she has a good relationship. She's been on three cruises since 2001, traveling through the U.S., and has never had a problem with U.S. authorities. No U.S. border agent has ever brought up the suicide attempt, including the agent on Monday, who only mentioned her hospitalization last year. He cited the U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 212, which denies entry to people who have had a physical or mental disorder that may, quote, pose a threat to the property, safety, or welfare, unquote, of themselves or others. System checks, said the agent, found she had a medical episode in June 2012, and because of the, quote, mental illness episode, unquote, she would need a medical evaluation before being accepted. How did the feds in this country know that she'd been hospitalized in Canada for depression? Because we must know. That's how. Some of the states, the new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, foreclosure, some of the states hit hardest by the foreclosure crisis, aren't spending the millions of dollars that the federal government has set aside to help struggling homeowners, according to a new report. Of the $7.6 billion the federal government has provided in the hardest hit fund, states have disbursed less than half, according to the Congressional Research Service. 18 states in the District of Columbia have programs that use money from the hardest hit fund, which is allocated to states depending on various factors, including the impact of the housing crisis in that state. 20% in Alabama is used. Alabama's used 21% of its hardest hit money. Some of the states hit hardest by the foreclosure crisis have distributed the lowest percentages, including Florida, Michigan, Arizona, and California. As of last month, Florida still had the nation's highest foreclosure rate. So it's hard to help the hardest hit when the hardest hit states don't want to help the hardest hit. Hello, welcome to the show.
you. And now I felt the love so real. I can see the love in you is easy. You sent shivers up and down my spine.
Up and down my spine.
There's no reason I can find your happiness. In you, I see the sign.
Sweetie, I see the sign.
You chase all my fears and doubts away.
Oh, yeah.
Filling me with blue skies and sunny days.
Sunny days.
I want to spend another day without you here. By my side. Together we can fly.
Together we can fly.
Can't stop.
Can't stop.
The way I feel. Every time I look into your eyes.
Minutes into year 31 of Hello, welcome to from London, England, right next to Leicester Square. Wow, a whole fun fair has been dumped into Leicester Square for our traffic convenience. I'm Harry Shearer, welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole, Jr. This is the story of the latest in the Winter Olympic torch relay. The torch has already been to outer space, where it was, of course, unlit to avoid exploding wherever it went in outer space. Russian organizers did something new this week, though, with their Olympic torch relay. They lit a former athlete on fire. It was an accident, reports the Toronto Globe and Mail. But many Russians fear it may set a symbolic tone for the Sochi Winter Olympics coming in February. This Sochi Olympic torch relay is the most ambitious in the history of the Winter Games. In Siberia late Wednesday, former Olympic bobsledder Pyotr Makarchuk nearly became a human sacrifice while he was jogging with the torch. It resembles a feather in shape and is colored with red and gray. It began to leak fuel. The fire spread from the torch to the sleeve on Makarchuk's left arm and had to be put out by a relay assistant. He was unhurt, became the second confirmed member of the Sochi Human Torch Club. In late October, the torch began spitting flames until it was fully engulfed. Initial reports said a 13-year-old girl had been burned. But organizing committee president Dmitry Chernyshenko clarified it was an employee, not a 13-year-old girl. The torch has also been spotted burning briefly out of control in the hands of a torch carrier dressed as Grandfather Frost, Russia's version of Santa Claus. Just keeping the flame lit has been a continuous problem. The relay got off to a fitful start last month when the flame went out minutes after it was hoisted by Putin in Red Square. A nearby government official leaned over and relit the torch, not with the flame that had been carefully transported from Greece, but with a Zippo lighter. Zippo tried to capitalize on the moment by posting a photo of the torch's relighting on Twitter. With the hashtag Zippo Saves the Olympics, it quickly dropped the campaign after being threatened with legal action by the International Olympic Committee. According to a Russian television channel, the flame died at least 8 more times in the first 6 days of the relay. Journalist Yulia Latinina counted up to 44 times the flame went out in the first 2 months of its journey. She's in trouble. At one outage, spectators were quoted as saying, "Is Gazprom sponsoring this?" Gazprom is Russia's government-controlled energy company. The mishaps have led to criticism of the factory in Krasnoyarsk, in the Siberian area, that produced a 16,000 set of copies of the torches for the relay. The same factory manufactures parts for Russian ballistic missiles, space rockets, and submarines. And that's the good news. Coming just 2 months from now, the Winter Olympics. It's a movement, and we all need one every day. Putin's gonna get you. Ladies and gentlemen, Just catching you up on, do you remember that spill? Remember that spill in the Gulf of Mexico a few years back? BP? Yeah, they tried to convince us they weren't a British company. So there's a legal case going on. The wheels of justice grinding exceeding slowly in New Orleans. A judge castigated in that case. The judge hearing that case castigated BP this week for whatever he castigated them for being BP. But here are other stories you may have missed recently about what's happened in the wake of that spill. Because everything's nice now, according to the commercials. The damage from oil during the spill to communities of tiny organisms living in and on the soft sediment of the floor of Gulf of Mexico surrounding the Macondo well will take decades to repair. This is according to a new scientific study conducted by NOAA, university researchers, and BP, because they care. According to the study published in the online scientific journal PLOS-1, the most damage to the abundance and diversity of tiny animal organisms extends a couple of miles from the wellhead in all directions, covering a 9.3-square-mile area. Moderate damage was seen in up to 10 miles of the southwest of the wellhead and 5 miles to the northeast. It's the first time a study has attempted to outline the breadth of damage to life on the sea floor around the ill-fated well. Ill-fated means people screwed up. The results will be used as part of the federal effort to determine how much damage has been done to natural resources by the oil, which determines how much BP pays. The analysis is based on sediment samples collected during two surveys after the well was capped. Sediment was sifted to remove the bottom-dwelling organisms, known as benthos. I didn't know that. And the scientists also identified a variety of compounds associated with the Macondo oil in the sediment, including various hydrocarbons and barium. We used to drink that before x-rays, didn't we? Barium is a mineral contained in the drilling mud. Pardon me. They just couldn't hold it. Used during the drilling of the well. The study found the damage to the bottom living organisms was statistically correlated to those contaminants and to the distance between the wellhead and the amount of damage. The damaged marine life extended along a narrow corridor about 23 miles long, which was consistent with earlier studies that identified the underwater stream of oil and gas residue. The tremendous biodiversity of fauna in the deep sea area of the Gulf of Mexico, as we studied, has been reduced dramatically, said one of the authors of the study, referring to small boneless organisms that range in size from 0.042 to 0.300 millimeters. Nematode worms have become the dominant group at sites we sampled that were impacted by the oil, said the author. So although the overall number of fauna may not have changed much, it's that we've lost the incredible biodiversity. The study was peer-reviewed, although the results were challenged by BP. Because they care. And oil collection on the Louisiana coastline from the Deepwater Horizon spill continues to increase 3 years after the disaster, according to a governor's representative in Louisiana. The combined efforts of the Coast Guard, state authorities, and BP resulted in the discovery of 2.9 million more pounds of oily matter between March and August this year than in the same period in 2012, says Drew Winters, an attorney with Governor Bobby Jindal's office. It just goes to show there's still a ton of oil out there. It's difficult to find, and we need to keep working to find it, unquote. The governor's aide. Because, ladies and gentlemen, say it with me now, because they care. And now, news of the warm, won't you? Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Here's Glenn.
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
In a major new international report, experts, hate to use that word, scientists conclude that the acidity of the world's ocean may increase by about 170% by the end of the century, bringing significant economic losses. People who rely on the ocean's ecosystem services, often in developing countries, are especially vulnerable. Scientists have agreed on levels of confidence in relation to ocean acidification statements, summarizing the state of knowledge. The summary was led by the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, and this was announced earlier, a group convened by the Third Symposium on the Ocean in a High CO2 World. Meanwhile, shifting, strengthening winds will help to counteract future sea level rises in Antarctica, and by doing so, they may help stabilize ice sheets on some parts of the southern continent. Boy, this would be good news. The band of westerly winds that encircles Antarctica has been speeding up and creeping southward since the 1950s, the trend largely driven by the ozone hole. See? And you thought that was a bad thing. Is expected to continue thanks to climate change and could alone cause a drop in sea level of up to 40 centimeters over 70 years, according to research led by Leela Frankum at the Center of Excellence for Climate System Science in Sydney, Australia. I guess that would be located right next door to the Center of Mediocrity in Climate Science. But these people do better work. Quote, that's really significant, says Amy Slangen, who studies sea level variation at the Australian Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and who was not involved with the study. This is reported by Nature.com. Along Antarctic shores, the effect of the winds could counteract almost half of the average global sea level rise expected by the end of the century. The reason for the sea level drop is, well, you know, the Coriolis force, right? It's a consequence of the Earth's rotation. Frankholm's results are not entirely surprising, writes Nature. Other climate models have similarly predicted this effect, but her model has a higher resolution, so it was able to include the effects of eddies in the Southern Ocean, which most full climate models are not able to incorporate. They're eddyless. The work is published in Geophysical Research Letters. Also finds that the southern shift of the wind by up to 4 degrees latitude over the next 70 years could significantly decrease the transfer of heat from the air to the sea, because the Southern Ocean plays a key role in global ocean circulation. This would lower the heat content of the entire ocean. In the absence of global warming, this chain of events could cause global sea levels to drop. So it all works out. The frozen permafrost under the East Siberian Arctic ice shelf, once considered an impermeable barrier trapping in lots of methane, has lately showed signs of instability and started leaking tons of methane into the atmosphere each year. A latest finding claims the amount of methane released by the Arctic seafloor is twice the previous estimates, and methane is a much more powerful global climate change-inducing gas than is CO2. According to the study results reported in the journal Nature Geoscience, the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, a methane-rich area that includes over 2 million square kilometers of seafloor in the Arctic, is releasing nearly 17 tetragrams, that's 17 million tons, ladies and gentlemen, of methane in the atmosphere each year. It's now on a par with methane being released from the Arctic tundra, which is considered to be one of the major sources of methane in the northern hemisphere, says one of the researchers. Methane is released on land when once frozen organic material decomposes. In seabeds, the greenhouse gas is stored as a preformed gas or in the form of methane hydrates. The methane is trapped as long as the subsea permafrost is frozen, but as the permafrost melts, it develops holes through which the trapped methane vents out. So it doesn't all work out. And emissions of methane from fossil fuel extraction and refining activities in the South Central United States, that would be like shale, fracking, are nearly 5 times higher than previous estimates. According to researchers at Harvard and 7 other institutions, their study published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences also suggests the contribution from livestock operations, you know, those huge hog farms where they do you know what, the methane contribution from them may be twice as high as previously thought. Overall, according to the new study, total methane emissions in the United States appear to be 1.5 times and or 1.7 times higher than the amounts previously estimated by the EPA and the International Emissions Database of Global Atmospheric Research, respectively. The difference lies in the methodology, if in fact differences can lie. Springtime plankton blooms off northern New England were well below average this year. You probably noticed that. You weren't having as much plankton, were you? This leads to the lowest levels ever seen for the tiny organisms that are essential to maintaining balance in the ocean food chain. This, according to Kevin Friedland, a marine scientist with NOAA. The absence of the normal surge of plankton in the spring. It's the one surge this administration hasn't been able to. They had a tech surge. That worked. But the plankton surge is a concern, or the lack of the plankton surge is a concern, because that's when cod and haddock and many other species produce offspring, says Friedland. The spring surge also provides the foundation for normally abundant zooplankton levels that have made waters from the Middle Atlantic to New England productive just for centuries. The first 6 months of 2013 can be characterized by new extremes in the physical and biological environment, says Friedland. The findings come after temperatures off the northeast coast hit an all-time high in 2012. But this year, sea surface temperatures moderated during the first 6 months of the year. They still remain, though, the third warmest on record. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this one right here, this very broadcast. About 30 years, babe. This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The British Foreign Office has apologized and paid compensation to a British woman who was raped by an Egyptian army officer and then left by embassy staff to seek medical treatment on her own. Nice people. She was also left to report the crime to the same authorities for whom her attackers worked. A report by the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman highlights a series of failures by the on-the-ground embassy staff and chides the Foreign Office for not being, quote, open and accountable. The actions were so poor, they were maladministrative, says the report. Wow. Typical British understatement, I hope. Embassy staff failed to offer to accompany the woman to report her crime, help her arrange a medical examination, help her find a lawyer, and help her to understand that she would need to be treated with a post-exposure prophylaxis to prevent HIV infection. The woman is a 35-year-old humanitarian worker living in Egypt. Was assaulted after being stopped at a security checkpoint. She said she would never trust a British embassy official again. The Foreign Office has apologized and has paid her £1,000 compensation. Dateline Columbia, South Carolina, Richland's election board this week apologized for the 1,114 absentee ballots that went uncounted in the election earlier this year, in November, indicating whoever made the mistake might be held accountable. There's your accountability right there. Might. The five members of the Richland County Voter Registration Commission issued an apology to county and city residents in the form of a letter to the editor of the local newspaper. I would like to offer my sincere apology to the citizens of Richland County for the most recent mishap of the election office, said Chairman Alan Dowdy. We ask your patience as we evaluate the leadership and staff of this office. More than 1,000 absentee ballots were absent, as befits their name. Milwaukee Brewers slugger Ryan Brown says he's made amends with a specimen collector he blamed during a news conference about a year and a half ago for what he described as a fatally flawed drug testing protocol in Major League Baseball. The former National League Most Valuable Player said he had dinner earlier this week at the home of the urine specimen collector, Dino Lorenzi Jr., and had apologized for his actions during some, quote, really good conversations. If you can't have really good conversations over dinner at the home of a urine specimen collector, where can you? I ask. The priest who asked mourners at a funeral in Cork, Ireland, to pray for a man before who was facing sex abuse charges in court has apologized to the family of the man whose funeral he was speaking at. Augustinian friar Father Martin Crean asked mourners at the funeral mass of John Cotter to pray for former Lord Mayor of Cork, John Murray, who was before the courts in one of the most high-profile cases of the year. Mourners at the funeral mass were stunned when they heard the priest's request. Cotter's family later said they were appalled. They were appalled bearers. The day after the funeral, a jury found Murray, who served as Lord Mayor in the 90s, guilty of 5 of the 6 charges of sex abuse brought against him. Father Crean, who was based in Feathered Tipperary, rang Cotter's family and apologized for any hurt he caused. One of Cotter's daughters described the week as hell. Panama's President Ricardo Montanelli apologized this week to relatives and survivors of a 2006 mass poisoning which claimed hundreds of lives. At least 400 people were killed after Barcelona-based Rasfer imported 2,300 gallons of glycerin from China and then sent it on to Panama, where it was used to make sugar-free syrup expectorant for hypertension and diabetes patients, widely distributed by the public health system in Panama. Man, this globalization thing is really kicking in. The syrup was contaminated with diethylene glycol, an industrial product not designed for human consumption. I want to ask your forgiveness in the name of the Panamanian state, Martinelli said in a ceremony where he officially delivered benefits, lifelong benefits, to survivors. Nothing that any of us can say could possibly make up for the loss of one human life, he said. Let us hope that this kind of incident and mass homicide never happens again. How many people? Is it in the story? Huh? A victim spokesman, Gabriel Pasquale, said families still were seeking justice. There are people who are still dying from this, and their future is not looking bright, he says. Just as mass poisoning. The Global Post does not tell us how many that means. Don't look at me. Just listen to me. Dateline El Paso, Texas, U.S. Representative Beto O'Rourke has apologized for participating in Twitter's public stock debut, a possible violation of House ethics rules. He has since sold his shares. Microsoft has issued an apology for and slightly altered the content of an Xbox One promo for which it came under fire on Wednesday. The promo, which has been accused of being sexist, not sexy, is pitched as a letter Microsoft has written for those who want to buy Xbox One to give to their significant others to convince them the purchase is worthwhile. The letter encourages users to edit certain phrases within it to their liking. The default settings for one phrase read, "Not sure if you heard, but Xbox One is now available. That means we can start playing games. I know you'd rather knit than watch me slay zombies." The promo material was accused of being sexist by commentators via Twitter. Says a Microsoft spokesperson, "The letter is customizable. We meant no offense. We're making changes to the letter defaults and apologize for the oversight." The promo now reads, quote, "I know you'd rather do your taxes early than watch me slay zombies." I think characterizing guys as wanting to play zombies, slay zombies, is sexist. But that's just me. Me? I'm and Dateline Afghanistan. The American military commander, General Joseph Dunford, has called President Karzai to apologize for a drone strike in southern Helmand province, which the military conceded had killed and wounded civilians, according to a coalition official. Earlier in the week, Karzai had condemned the airstrike for having killed a small child and injuring two women in southern Helmand province. He said the raid on the house was another sign of America's disregard for civilian life. This came at a delicate moment when talks between Karzai and the United States over a long-term security agreement have reached an impasse. The Americans have told Karzai unless he signs the agreement promptly, the U.S. will begin with planning for a total withdrawal of forces before the end of next year, the so-called zero option. General Dunford made a late-night phone call to President Karzai after the president's criticism became public. He talked to President Karzai directly, expressed deep regrets for the incident and any civilian casualties, and promised to convene an immediate joint investigation to determine all the facts of what happened, said a coalition spokesman. Karzai vowed this week at the end of a loya jirga, or grand council, that he would cancel the security agreement completely if there was even one more raid that killed civilians. On Thursday, he said, in effect, that moment had come. For as long as such arbitrary acts and oppression of foreign forces continue, he said, the security agreement will not be signed. The loya jirga overwhelmingly approved the security agreement last week and called on Karzai to sign it quickly. Karzai said he was adding a series of new conditions beyond what he had already negotiated. Well, we've segued right from the apologies of the week to news of AFPAC, haven't we? Karzai was adding a series of new conditions beyond what he had already negotiated and would not sign until those were satisfied. One of them, an immediate ban on any raids on Afghan homes by the Americans or the Allies. His statement made it clear he now included drone strikes in his suggested prohibition. The coalition spokesman confirmed two drone incidents had taken place in Helmand, where the civilian victims were on the road near a home that was targeted. Other news of AFPAC, Afghanistan's government has backed away from a proposal to reintroduce public stoning as a punishment for adultery, after the leak of a draft law stirred up a storm of international condemnation. President Karzai said the penalty, which became a symbol of Taliban brutality when they were in power, will not be coming back. Dateline Ottawa, Canadians' arrest for attempted nuclear smuggling to Pakistan in 1987 sharply divided U.S. leaders over whether to punish the rogue nuclear state or disregard its illicit atomic ambitions to preserve Pakistani aid to the Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. According to recently declassified U.S. government documents, the administration of President Reagan eventually decided that aiding the anti-Soviet war trumped non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And President Karzai did make a new set of demands for signing the agreement to keep troops there when U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice made a two-hour stop in Kabul. The Washington Post today reported that even though the U.S. has been saying all along if the agreement was not signed by the end of the year, the zero option would start to take effect, the Washington Post now reports that the Pentagon has never really been serious or that serious about the zero option, which, given President Karzai's recalcitrance, seems as though somebody's backing away from something in a game of chicken. Well, that's how it looks from here. How does it look from over there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where our American trainers have already gone home.
From the almost assassination-proof presidential palace in downtown Kabul, the city is so nice they named it. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Slick and Slack, the Hoggle Brothers. Welcome to Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Afghanistan Rifle Association, where the Second Amendment comes first.
Well, my brother, you have had a momentous week, an agreement with the Americans, a very special lawyer, Jugger.
Yes, it was a very special one, even though it didn't have Lady Gaga as a guest star.
And we still don't know whether American troops will be in our country after next year.
Yes, I guess it all depends on the pomegranate harvest.
Well, the Americans think it's healthy.
Very healthy. Somebody figured out how to make $1 billion out of the juice of those ugly little things.
And it wasn't one of our brothers.
No. And they wonder why we hate them.
Our brothers?
No, the Americans. Our brothers know why we hate them. Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, this is General Dunford, a long-time listener. First-time apologizer.
Oh, this is an honor, General.
Thank you.
May I inquire if you're in the market for a pre-owned Toyota?
Oh, stop it, stop it. He gets his cars from where we do.
The U.S. government.
Yes.
And I'm supposed to be grateful for the competition.
Guys, if I may, I've got a war to wind down here. Can I just get a word in?
Well, I'd hate to think that actual content is more appealing to listeners than corny banter, but go ahead.
Hamid, I know we had a private conversation earlier in the week.
Private, except for the NSA listening in.
Well, I can't comment on that, but I did want to call you up here on the radio just to repeat my apology to you.
Oh, well, thanks, General. How did it go again?
Yes, we love playing the oldies.
Well, sir, I just wanted to say how sorry we are that one of the unarmed aircraft that I'm not authorized to say that we fly appeared to have terminated an Afghan youngster this week in a terrible accident that nobody not paying attention could have foreseen. How's that?
General, I'd say if it was any more sincere, we'd owe royalties to Oprah.
Well, and General, I hope you noticed that we've rolled back the troublesome little tilt towards Sharia law, the revival of our historic stoning punishment.
We were very heartened by that, Mahmoud. It reaffirms our belief that the new Afghanistan will be a bastion of human rights. As a matter of fact, around NATO headquarters, we have a slogan that sums up our thinking on it.
Oh, really? What is that?
Droning is better than stoning.
Thanks for the call.
Say what you will about the Americans. They are world-class sloganeers.
Well, as a matter of fact, what you just said, that's one of theirs.
Yes, it is.
Hello, you are on Karzai Talk.
Hello, I'm Susan. First-time National Security Advisor, long-time caller.
Oh, you walk in the footsteps of Henry Kissinger.
Well,
so you should be hoping the International Court at The Hague has bigger fish to fry.
Susan,
yes.
Again, we talked off the air, but now we're talking on the air, and I would say the difference is
the air.
Well, I just wanted to make it even clearer than I did when I was actually there.
Oh, it's so hard to be clear when you're here.
That without an agreement for American troops to stay there that's signed by the end of the year, American troops can't stay there by the end of next year. It's kind of like that.
Well, of course, we have said that we have to wait until after presidential elections to sign anything.
Yes.
Because...
Only the new president can restock the pen supply.
Exactly. Mm. But the Americans want us to be a democracy, mm-hmm. So maybe we should open the phone lines and see what other conditions our people might want for the continued presence of American troops.
Well,
I think that's a good idea.
Oh, yes.
Hello, you are on Cars I Talk with Susan.
Hello, Susan.
Hello.
I think the most valuable thing the Americans can send us is economic aid, and we don't need your troops for that.
Unless your troops come equipped with the latest ATM software.
Okay, I hear you.
But maybe after seeing your progress on healthcare, Susan, maybe we should pay you not to send the software. Hello, line 3. You are on Cars I Talk with Susan Rice.
Hello, Madam National Security Advisor. Mm-hmm. I think a condition for American aid and troops remaining committed to our country is a commitment by our government to the equal treatment of women before the law.
Well, I think empowerment of women is one of the key objectives that we've had during this whole engagement.
Engagement? We are just good friends.
Caller, if there is any cause to which I'm totally committed, it is the cause of equal rights for women.
And that, of course, is the world's biggest if.
Stop that now. Susan,
yes.
Are you agreeing that empowerment of women is an important condition for us to agree on before our agreement is signed?
Hamid, I'm one of the most empowered women this side of Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to get this thing signed before the end of the year, full stop.
Oh, Susan, why do you hate women's freedom?
One more call. Hello, you are on with Susan.
Hello, Madam Advisor.
Hello.
I definitely think one condition for allowing American troops to remain in a country that historically has hated foreign troops is to ensure continued economic association with the Karzai family, which knows how to make the connections to, shall we say, soften such hatred.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Mm-hmm. We've heard a very similar suggestion from members of the Karzai family itself.
Oh, well, I'm in the Karzai family itself. I'm Hamid's cousin, Ahmed.
Madam Advisor, I'm so sorry. Mahmoud, I thought you screened these calls.
I did. We ran out of brothers.
Well, just remember, Hamid, as far as we're concerned, the zero option is very much on the table.
You know, my dear younger brother, I seriously doubt that Americans would like to hear that their 12 years of expense and sacrifice has suddenly been zeroed out.
Nobody likes to take the long way to Goose Eggsville.
Well, Hamid,
yes.
I doubt that your folks will be all that happy when the dollar train stops running.
Ooh.
As far as I know, we were the only people who donated to your last pledge drive.
I know. But think of all the tote bags we saved. Thanks for the call.
We had help today from the Private Military Contractors Foundation. A modern army travels on our stomach.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud. Join us again for another edition of Cars I Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Friends love me, 'cause I'm settled and I'm sane. I don't want to hurt them by showing them the crazy state I'm in. The crazy state I'm in. I do whatever I can do, but it seems that when it comes to you, darling, enough is never quite enough.
Never quite enough.
We've all got secrets. Everybody has their shame.
Everybody's got their shame.
Sometimes you fight them, but one thing's sure, they'll rise back up again.
Yes, they will.
They'll rise back up again. Sex, pills or booze, whatever helps to soothe your blues. But you know, enough is never quite enough. Mm-hmm. Never quite enough. People seem happy,
mm-hmm.
So they make you think. We all need comfort, a nameless face, an early morning dream. An early morning dream. And if you want to dim those memories, sit back, relax, and give in, please, but you know. Enough is never quite enough. Never quite enough. And if you want to dim those memories, sit back, relax, and give in, please. But you know, enough is never. Never quite enough.
No, no, never quite enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jesus.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Now, news of our friend the Atom. Addy, our friend the Atom, did you have trouble getting here today?
I just spun in.
No traffic for you, huh?
No, sir.
Dateline Plymouth, the owners of the Plymouth Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Massachusetts, violated federal regulations by letting their employees work more hours than rules allow, operating when both of the plant's meteorological towers were down, and failing to meet a federal security requirement. According to a routine check of the plant and its records by federal inspectors, the NRC stress all three findings were of very low safety significance. The company will be required to submit a plan to correct the shortcomings.
That's the way they regulate. The soft touch.
President Ma Ying-jeou of Taiwan in Taipei defended his administration's efforts to ensure the safety of nuclear power plants, citing major precautionary measures at the fourth plant in New Taipei City's Gongliao district that include destroying the plant if necessary to prevent a nuclear disaster.
Have to destroy the plant to save it?
Mm-hmm. During a meeting with a group of Japanese academics and engineers, he said the disaster at Fuk had prompted Taiwan to examine the reasons behind the disaster and enhance the safety at his plants. He said a system was established to destroy the plant if a disaster is about to happen. We can destroy the whole plant to avoid radiation leaks if the situation is about to go out of control. We firmly believe nuclear power should. We firmly believe no nuclear power should exist without nuclear safety. How do you destroy a plant to avoid radiation and not release radiation?
Ask Ma.
TEPCO said Thursday a shortage of water storage tanks had forced it to postpone removal of radioactive groundwater at its crippled Fuk No. 1 power station. This would allow radioactive groundwater to continue to flow beyond the hardened soil between reactors 2 and 3 and into the sea. Earlier this month, about 6,000 becquerels per liter of strontium-90 and other beta-ray-emitting radioactive substances were detected in groundwater. far exceeding the standard for water to be released into the sea.
Hot fish.
Hot fish. And typhoons that hit Japan each year are helping to spread radioactive material from the Fuk disaster into the country's waterways, according to researchers. Contaminated soil gets washed away by the high winds and rain and deposited in streams and rivers, says Tsukuba University and French researchers. An earthquake after the accident, a number of radioactive particles were flung to the atmosphere, dispersing cesium particles, which typically cling to soils and sediment. Soil erosion can move the radioactive varieties of cesium from the northern mountains near Fuk into rivers and then out into the Pacific. There is a definite dispersal towards the ocean, says one researcher.
Don't buy ocean stocks.
Don't buy ocean stocks. Good advice from Addy the Atom. Clean, cheap, safe. Too wise to meet her.
I could cry solid tears. Where have I been all these years? Listen, you, why don't you tell me true? How long has this been going on? There were chills up my spine and some thrills I can't define. Listen, sweet, while I repeat, how long has this been going on? Oh, I feel like I could melt into heaven. I'm hurled. I know how Columbus felt, finding another. Me once, then once more. What a fool I was before. Oh, what a break for heaven's sake. How long has this been going on? Lost my sense of timing. What's the use denying? I was a fool, but now I know that I can throw my dunce's cap away, darling. I'm begging for a break. Right now's the time to discover. Cuddle close, sound in your ear and whisper gently how I love you so. I wanted to tell you for a long, long time, but I never could find the courage or the strength. Don't ask me why, I must have been crazy, but baby, I'm all right now. We're sticking together forever, you know that's a very long time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, available via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShear.com and KCSN.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through WWNO.org, iTunes, SoundCloud.com, and a few others that I forget at this crucial moment. And it'd be just like remembering them if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show chapeau to all the stations that have been with us since near the beginning when we started syndicating. 26 years of our 30 years ago. A tip of the show, chapeau to the stations that have joined us lately. And a tip of the show, chapeau to all of you for listening for however long you've been with us. Also, to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Adrian Bodnum. Chipper Adrian Bodnum here at Global Radio for help with today's, real help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program and the playlist of the music you heard here on, and a killer store for those Christmas gifts. Yes, it's that time of year already to be nattered about that. All of that is at harryshearer.com. And me? I'm the Harry Shearer at Twitter. I'm verified. I guess 30 is the new 60. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, Louisiana. Flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.